Can she hear me?
Absolutely, I answer, more for myself than for her.
I won't go to Minnesota, Anna whispers. I won't ever go anywhere.
She leans close.
Wake up, Kate.
We both hold our breath, but nothing happens. I have never understood why it is called losing a child. No parent is that careless. We all know exactly where our sons and daughters are. We just don't necessarily want them to be there. Brian and Kate and I are a circuit. We sit on each side of the bed and hold each other's hands, and one of hers.
You were right, I tell him. We should have taken her home.
Brian shakes his head. If we hadn't tried the arsenic, we'd spend the rest of our lives asking why not. He brushes back the pale hair that surrounds Kate's face. She's such a good girl. She's always done what you ask her to do. I nod, unable to speak. That's why she's hanging on, you know. She wants your permission to leave. He bends down to Kate, crying so hard he cannot catch his breath. I put my hand on his head. We are not the first parents to lose a child, but we are the first parents to lose our child. And that makes all the difference. When Brian falls asleep, draped over the foot of the bed, I take Kate's scarred hand between both of mine. I trace the ovals of her nails and remember the first time I painted them, when Brian couldn't believe I'd do that to a one-year-old. Now, 12 years later, I turn over her palm and wish I knew how to read it, or better yet, how to edit that lifeline. I pull my chair closer to the hospital bed.
Do you remember the summer we signed you up for camp? And the night before you left, you said you'd changed your mind and wanted to stay home? I told you to get a seat on the left side of the bus so that when it pulled away, you'd be able to look back and see me there waiting for you.
I press her hand against my cheek, hard enough to leave a mark.
You get that same seat in heaven, one where you can watch me watching you.
I bury my face in the blankets and tell this daughter of mine how much I love her. I squeeze her hand one last time. Only to feel the slightest pulse, the tiniest grasp, the smallest clutch of Kate's fingers as she claws her way back to this world.
Anna. Here's my question. What age are you when you're in heaven? I mean, if it's heaven, you should be at your beauty queen best, and I doubt that all people who die of old age are wandering around toothless and bald. It opens up a whole additional realm of questions, too. If you hang yourself, do you walk around all gross and blue with your tongue spitting out of your mouth? If you're killed in a war, do you spend eternity minus the leg that got blown up in a mine? I figure that maybe you get a choice. You fill out the application form that asks you if you want a star view or a cloud view, if you like chicken or fish or manna for dinner, what age you'd like to be seen as by everyone else. Like me, for example, I might pick 17, in the hopes I grow boobs by then, and even if I'm a pruny centenarian by the time I die, in heaven I'd be young and pretty. Once at a dinner party, I heard my father say that even though he was old, 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 in his heart he was 21. So maybe there is a place in your life you wear out like a rut, or even better, like the soft spot on the couch. And no matter what else happens to you, you come back to that. The problem, I suppose, is that everyone's different. What happens in heaven when all these people are trying to find each other after so many years spent apart? Say that you die and start looking around for your husband who died 5 years ago. What if you're picturing him at 70, but he hit his groove at 16 and is wandering around, suave as can be? Or what if you're Kate, and you die at 16, but in heaven you choose to look 35, an age you never got to be here on earth? How would anyone ever be able to find you? Campbell calls my father at the station when we're having lunch and says that opposing counsel wants to talk about the case, which is a really stupid way to put it, since we all know he's talking about my mother. He says we all have to meet at 3 o'clock in his office, no matter that it's Sunday. I sit on the floor with Judge's head in my lap. Campbell is so busy he doesn't even tell me not to do it. My mother arrives right on the dot, and, since Carrie, the secretary, is off today, walks in by herself. She has made a special effort to pull her hair back into a neat bun. She's put on some makeup. But unlike Campbell, who wears this room like an overcoat he can shrug on and off, my mom looks completely out of place in a law firm. It's hard to believe that my mother used to do this for a living. I guess she used to be someone else once. I suppose we all were. Hello? She says quietly. Ms. Fitzgerald, Campbell replies. Ice. My mother's eyes move from my father at the conference table to me on the floor. Hi, she says again. She steps forward like she is going to hug me, but she stops. You called this meeting, counselor, Campbell prompts. My mother sits down. I know, I was... Well, I'm hoping that we can clear this up. I want us to make a decision together. Campbell wraps his fingers on the table. Are you offering us a deal? He makes it sound so businesslike. My mother blinks at him. Yes, I guess I am. She turns her chair toward me, as if only the two of us are in the room. Anna, I know how much you've done for Kate. I also know she doesn't have many chances left. But she might have this one. My client doesn't need coercing. It's okay, Campbell, I say. Let her talk. If the cancer comes back, if this kidney transplant doesn't work, if things don't wind up the way we all wish they would for Kate, well, I will never ask you to help your sister again. But Anna, will you do this one last thing? By now she looks very tiny, smaller even than me, as if I'm the parent and she is the child. I wonder how this optical illusion took place when neither of us have moved. I glance at my father, but he's gone bolder still, and he seems to be doing everything he can to follow the grain of wood in the conference table instead of getting involved. Are you indicating that if my client willingly donates a kidney, then she will be absolved of all other medical procedures that may be necessary in the future to prolong Kate's life? Campbell clarifies. My mother takes a deep breath. Yes. We need, of course, to discuss it. When I was 7, Jesse went out of his way to make sure I wasn't stupid enough to believe in Santa. It's Mom and Dad, he explained, and I fought him every step of the way. I decided to test the theory. So that Christmas, I wrote to Santa and asked for a hamster, which is what I wanted most in the world. I mailed the letter myself in the school secretary's mailbox, and I steadfastly did not tell my parents, although I dropped other hints about toys I hoped for that year. On Christmas morning, I got the sled and the computer game and the tie-dyed comforter I had mentioned to my mother, but I did not get the hamster because she didn't know about it. I learned two things that year. That neither Santa nor my parents were what I wanted them to be. Maybe Campbell thinks this is about the law, but really, it's about my mother. I get up from the floor and fly into her arms, which are a little like that spot in life I was talking about before, so familiar that you slide right back to the place where you fit. It makes my throat hurt, and all those tears I've been saving come out of their hiding place. Oh, Anna, she cries into my hair. Thank God, thank God. I hug her twice as tight as I would normally, trying to hold on to this moment the same way I like to paint the slanted light of summer on the back wall of my brain, a mural to stare at during the winter. I put my lips right up to her ear, and even as I speak, I wish I wasn't. I can't. My mother's body goes stiff. She pulls away from me, stares at my face. Then she pushes a smile onto her lips that is broken in several spots. She touches the crown of my head. That's it. She stands up, straightens her jacket, and walks out of the office. Campbell gets out of his seat, too. He crouches down in front of me, in the place where my mother was. Eye to eye, he looks more serious than I have ever seen him look. "Anna," he says, "is this really what you want?" I open my mouth and find an answer.
Julia.
"Do you think I like Campbell because he's an asshole?" I ask my sister. "Or in spite of it?" Izzy shushes me from the couch. She is watching The Way We Were, a movie she's seen 20,000 times. It's on her list of movies you cannot click past, which also includes Pretty Woman, Ghost, and Dirty Dancing. "If you make me miss the end, Julia, I'll kill you." "See ya, Katie," I quote for her. "See ya, Hubble." She throws a couch pillow at me and wipes her eyes as the theme music swells. "Barbara Streisand," Izzy says, "is the bomb." I thought that was a gay men's stereotype. I look up over the table of papers I have been studying in preparation for tomorrow's hearing. This is the decision I will render to the judge, based on what is in Anna Fitzgerald's best interests. The problem is, it doesn't matter whether I side in her favor or against her. Either way, I will be ruining her life. "I thought we were talking about Campbell," Izzy says. "No, I was talking about Campbell. You were swooning." I rub my temples. "I thought you might be sympathetic." "About Campbell Alexander? I'm not sympathetic. I'm apathetic." "You're right. That is what kind of pathetic you are." "Look, Julia, maybe it's hereditary," Izzy says. She gets up and starts rubbing the muscles of my neck. "Maybe you have a gene that attracts you to absolute jerks." "Then you have it too." "Well," she laughs, "case in point." I want to hate him, you know, just for the record. Reaching over my shoulder, Izzy takes the Coke I'm drinking and finishes it off. "What happened to this being strictly professional?" "It is. There's just a very vocal minority opposition group, in my mind, wishing otherwise." Izzy sits back down on the couch. "The problem, you know, is that you never forget your first one. And even if your brain's smart about it, your body's got the IQ of a fruit fly." "It's just so easy with him, Iz. It's like we're picking up where we left off. I already know everything I need to know about him, and he already knows everything he needs to about me." I look at her. "Can you fall for someone because you're lazy? Why don't you just screw him and get it out of your system?" "Because," I say, "as soon as it's over, that's one more piece of the past I won't be able to get rid of." "I can fix you up with one of my friends," Izzy suggests. "They all have vaginas." "See, you're looking at the wrong stuff, Julia. You ought to be attracted to someone for what they've got inside them, not for the package it's presented in. Campbell Alexander may be gorgeous, but he's like marzipan frosting on a sardine." "You think he's gorgeous?" Izzy rolls her eyes. "You," she says, "are doomed." When the doorbell rings, Izzy goes to look through the peephole. Speak of the devil.
It's Campbell?
I whisper. Tell him I'm not here. Izzy opens the door just a few inches. Julia says she's not here.
I'm going to kill you, I mutter, and walk up behind her.
Pushing her out of the way, I undo the chain and let Campbell and his dog inside.
The reception here just keeps getting warmer and fuzzier, he says.
I cross my arms. What do you want? I'm working.
Good.
Sarah Fitzgerald just offered us a plea bargain. Come out to dinner with me, and I'll tell you all about it.
I am not going out to dinner with you, I tell him.
Actually, you are, he shrugs. I know you, and eventually you're going to give in because even more than you don't want to be with me, you want to know what Anna's mother said. Can't we just cut to the chase?
Izzy starts laughing.
He does know you, Julia.
If you don't go willingly, Campbell adds, I have no problem using brute force, although it's going to be considerably more difficult for you to cut your filet mignon if your hands are tied together.
I turn to my sister. Do something, please.
She waves at me.
See ya, Katie.
See ya, Hubble,
Campbell replies.
Great movie.
Izzy looks at him, considering.
Maybe there's hope, she says.
Rule number one, I tell him. We talk about the trial and nothing but the trial.
So help me God, Campbell adds.
And may I just say you look beautiful?
See? You've already broken the rule.
He pulls into a parking lot near the water and cuts the engine. Then he gets out of the car and comes around to my side to help me out. I look around, but I don't see anything resembling a restaurant. We are at a marina filled with sailboats and yachts, their honey-colored decks tanning in the late sun.
Take off your sneakers, Campbell says.
No.
For God's sake, Julia, this isn't the Victorian age. I'm not going to attack you because I see your ankle. Just do it, will you?
Why?
Because right now, you've got an enormous pole up your ass, and this is the only G-rated way I can think of to make you relax.
He pulls off his own deck shoes and sinks his feet into the grass growing along the edge of the parking lot.
Ah, he says, and he spreads his arms wide. Come on, Jewel. Carpe diem.
Summer's almost over. Better enjoy it while you can.
What about the plea bargain?
What Sarah said is going to remain the same whether or not you go barefoot. I still do not know if he's taken on this case because he's a glory hound, because he wants the PR, or if he simply wanted to help Anna.
I want to believe the latter, idiot that I am.
Campbell waits patiently, the dog at his side. Finally, I untie my sneakers and peel off my socks. I step out onto the strip of lawn. Summertime, I think, is a collective unconscious. We all remember the notes that made up the song of the ice cream man. We all know what it feels like to brand our thighs on a playground slide that's heated up like a knife in a fire. We all have lain on our backs, with our eyes closed and our hearts beating across the surface of our lids, hoping that this day will stretch just a little longer than the last one, when in fact, it's all going in the other direction. Campbell sits down on the grass.
What's rule number two?
That I get to make up all the rules, I say. When he smiles at me, I'm lost.
Last night, Seven the bartender slipped a martini into my waiting hand and asked me what I was hiding from. I took a sip before I answered and reminded myself why I hate martinis.
They're straight, bitter alcohol. Which, of course, is the point. But they also taste that way. Which is always somehow disappointing. I'm not hiding, I told him. I'm here, aren't I? It was early at the bar. Just dinner time. I stopped in on my way back from the fire station, where I'd been with Anna. Two guys were making out in a booth in the corner. One lone man was sitting at the other end of the bar. Can we change the channel? He gestured toward the TV, which was broadcasting the evening news. Jennings is so much hotter than Brokaw. Seven flicked the remote, then turned back to me. You're not hiding, but you're sitting in a gay bar at dinner time. You're not hiding, but you're wearing that suit like it's armor. Well, I'd definitely take fashion advice from a guy with a pierced tongue. Seven lifted a brow. One more martini and I could convince you to go see my man Johnston and get your own done. You can take the pink hair dye out of the girl, but you never lose those roots. I took another sip of the martini. You don't know me. At the end of the bar, the other customer lifted his face to Peter Jennings and smiled. Maybe, Seven said. But neither do you. Dinner turns out to be bread and cheese. Well, a baguette and gruyere on board a 30-foot sailboat. Campbell rolls up his pants like a castaway and sets the rigging and hauls line and catches the wind until we are so far away from the shore of Providence that it is only a line of color, a distant jeweled necklace. After a while, when it becomes clear to me that any information Campbell feels like providing me with won't be doled out until after dessert, I give in. I lie on my back with my arm draped over the sleeping dog. I watch the sail, loose now, flap like the great white wing of a pelican. Campbell comes up from below decks, where he's been hunting down a corkscrew, and holds out two glasses of red wine. He sits down on the other side of Judge and scratches behind the German Shepherd's ears. You ever think about being an animal? Figuratively or literally? Rhetorically, he says. If you hadn't drawn that human card. I think about this for a while. Is this a trick question? Like, if I say killer whale, you're going to tell me that means I'm a ruthless, cold-blooded, bottom-feeder fish? They're mammals, Campbell says. And no, it's just a simple, making polite conversation inquiry. I turn my head. What would you be? I asked you first. Well, a bird is out of the question. I'm too scared of heights. I don't think I have the right attitude to be a cat. And I'm too much of a loner to function in a pack, like a wolf or a dog. I think of saying something like tarsier, just to show off. But then he'll ask what the hell that is, and I can't remember if it is a rodent or a lizard. A goose, I decide. Campbell bursts out laughing. As in mother or silly? It is because they mate for life. But I would rather fall overboard than tell him this. What about you? But he doesn't answer me directly. When I asked Anna the same question, she told me she'd be a phoenix. The image of the mythical creature rising from the ashes glitters in my mind. They don't really exist. Campbell strokes the dog's head. She said that depends whether or not there's someone who can see them. Then he looks up at me. How do you see her, Julia? The wine I have been drinking suddenly tastes bitter. Was all this, the charm, the picnic, the sunset sail, engineered to tip my hand in his favor at tomorrow's trial? Whatever I recommend as guardian ad litem will weigh heavily in Judge DeSalvo's decision, and Campbell knows it. Until this moment, I had not realized that someone could break your heart twice along the very same fault lines. I'm not going to tell you what my decision is, I say stiffly. You can wait to hear it when you call me as a witness. I grab for the anchor and try to reel it in. I'd like to go back now, please. Campbell yanks the line out of my hand. You already told me that you don't think it's in Anna's best interest to be a kidney donor for her sister. I also told you she's incapable of making that decision by herself. Her father moved her out of the house. He can be her moral compass. And how long is that going to last? What about the next time? I am furious at myself for falling for this, for agreeing to go out to dinner, for letting myself believe that Campbell might want to be with me rather than use me. Everything, from his compliments on my looks to the wine sitting on the deck between us, has been coldly calculated to help him win his case. Sarah Fitzgerald offered us a deal, Campbell says. She said if Anna donates the kidney, she will never ask her to do anything for her sister again. Anna turned it down. You know, I could have the judge throw you in jail for this. It's completely unethical to try to seduce me into changing my mind. Seduce you? All I did was lay the cards on the table for you. I made your job easier. Oh, right. Forgive me, I say sarcastically. This isn't about you. This isn't about me writing my report with a definite slant toward your client's petition. If you were an animal, Campbell, you know what you'd be? A toad. No, actually, you'd be a parasite on the belly of a toad. Something that takes what it needs without giving a single thing back. A vein throbs blue in his temple. Are you finished? Actually, I'm not. Is anything that comes out of your mouth ever honest? I did not lie to you. No? What's the dog for, Campbell? Jesus Christ, will you shut up already? Campbell says, and he pulls me into his arms and kisses me. His mouth moves like a silent story. He tastes like salt and wine. There is no moment of relearning, of adjusting the patterns of the past 15 years. Our bodies remember where to go. He licks my name along the course of my throat. He presses himself so close to me that any hurt left on the surface between us spreads thin, becomes a binding instead of a boundary. When we break away to breathe again, Campbell stares at me. I'm still right, I whisper. It's the most natural thing in the world when Campbell pulls my old sweatshirt up over my head, works at the clasp of my bra. When he kneels before me with his head over my heart, when I feel the water rocking the hull of the boat, I think that maybe this is the place for us. Maybe there are entire worlds where there are no fences, where feeling bears you like a tide.
Monday. From the New Testament, James chapter 3, verse 5. How great a matter a little fire kindleth. Campbell. We sleep in the tiny cabin, moored to its slip. Tight quarters, but that hardly seems to matter. All night long, she fits herself around me. She snores, just a little. Her front tooth is crooked. Her eyelashes are as long as the nail of my thumb. These are the minutiae that prove, more than anything else, the difference between us now that 15 years have passed. When you're 17, you don't think about whose apartment you want to sleep in. When you're 17, you don't even see the pearl pink of her bra, the lace that arrows between her legs. When you're 17, it's all about the now, not the after. What I had loved about Julia. There. I've said it now. Was that she didn't need anyone. At Wheeler, even when she stood out with her pink hair and quilted army surplus jacket and combat boots, she did this without apology. It was a great irony that the very fact of a relationship with her would diminish her appeal. That the moment she came to love me back and depend on me as much as I depended on her, she would no longer be a truly independent spirit. No way in hell was I going to be the one to take that quality away from her. After Julia, there weren't all that many women. None whose names I took the time to remember, anyway. It was far too complicated to maintain the facade. Instead, I chose the coward's rocky route of one-night stands. Out of necessity, medical and emotional, I've gotten rather skilled at being an escape artist. But there are half a dozen times this past night when I had the opportunity to leave. While Julia was sleeping, I even considered how to do it. A note pinned to the pillow, a message scrawled on the deck with her cherry lipstick. And yet the urge to do this was nowhere near as strong as the need to wait just one more minute, one more hour. From the spot where he's curled up on the galley table, tight as a cinnamon bun, Judge raises his head. He whines a little, and I completely understand. Detangling myself from Julia's rich forest of hair, I slip out of the bed. She inches into the warm spot I've left behind. I swear, it makes me hard again. But instead of doing what comes naturally, that is, calling in sick with some latent strain of smallpox and making the clerk of the court reschedule a hearing so that I can spend the day getting laid, I pull on my pants and go above deck. I want to make sure I'm at the courthouse before Anna and need to shower and change. I leave Julia the keys to my car. It's a short walk to my place. It's only when Judge and I are on our way home that I realize, unlike every other bloodshot morning that I have left a woman, I haven't fashioned some charming symbol of my exit for Julia, something to lessen the blow of abandonment upon waking. I wonder if this was an oversight, or if I have been waiting all this time for her to come back so that I can grow up. When Judge and I arrive at the Garrahy building for the hearing, we have to fight our way through the reporters who have lined up for the main event. They thrust microphones in my face and inadvertently step on Judge's paws. Anna will take one look at walking this gauntlet and bolt. Inside the front door, I flag down Vern. "Get us some security out here, will you?" I tell him. "They're going to eat the witnesses alive." Then I see Sarah Fitzgerald already waiting. She's wearing a suit that most likely hasn't seen the outside of the plastic dry cleaner's bag for a decade, and her hair is pulled back severely into a barrette. She doesn't carry a briefcase, but a knapsack instead. "Good morning," I say evenly. The door blows open and Brian enters, looking from Sarah to me. "Where's Anna?" Sarah takes a step forward. "Didn't she come here with you?" "She was already gone when I got back from a call at 5 a.m. She left a note and said she'd meet me here." He glances at the door at the jackals on the other side. "I bet she took off." Again, there is the sound of a seal being breached, and then Julia surfs into the courthouse on a crest of shouts and questions. She smooths back her hair, gets her bearings, then looks at me and loses them again. "I'll find her," I say. Sarah bristles. "No, I will." Julia looks at each of us. "Find who?" "Anna is temporarily absent," I explain.
"Absent?"
Julia says. "As in disappeared?" "Not at all." This isn't a lie, either. For Anna to have disappeared, she would have had to appear in the first place. I realize that I even know where I am headed, at the same moment that Sarah understands it too. In that moment, she lets me take the lead. Julia grabs my arm as I'm walking toward the door. She shoves my car keys into my hand. Now you do understand why this isn't going to work. I turned to her. Julia, listen. I want to talk about what's going on between us too, but this isn't the right time. I was talking about Anna. Campbell, she's waffling. She couldn't even show up for her own court date. What does that say to you? That everyone gets scared, I answer finally. Fair warning for all of us. The shades to the hospital room are drawn, but that doesn't keep me from seeing the angel pallor of Kate Fitzgerald's face, the web of blue veins mapping out the last chance path of medication running under her skin. Curled up on the foot of the bed is Anna. At my command, Judge waits by the door. I crouch down. Anna, it's time to go. When the door to the hospital room opens, I'm expecting either Sarah Fitzgerald or a doctor with a crash cart. Instead, to my shock, Jesse stands on the threshold. Hey, he says, as if we are old friends. How did you get here? I almost ask, but realize I don't want to hear the answer. We're on our way to the courthouse. Need a lift? I ask dryly.
No, thanks. I thought since everyone was going to be there, I'd stay here.
His eyes do not waver from Kate.
She looks like shit.
What do you expect? Anna answers, awake now.
She's dying.
Again, I find myself staring at my client. I should know better than most that motivations are never what they seem to be, but I still cannot figure her out. We need to go. In the car, Anna rides shotgun while Judge takes a seat in the back. She starts telling me about some crazy precedent she found on the internet, where a guy in Montana in 1876 was legally prohibited from using the water from a river that originated on his brother's land, even though it meant all his crops would dry up. What are you doing? She asks, when I deliberately miss the turn to the courthouse. Instead, I pull over next to a park. A girl with a great ass jogs by, holding onto the leash of one of those frou-frou dogs that looks more like a cat.
We're going to be late,
Anna says after a moment. We already are. Look, Anna, what's going on here? She gives me one of those patented teenage looks, as if to say that there's no way she and I descended from the same evolutionary chain.
We're going to court.
That's not what I'm asking. I want to know why we're going to court.
Well, Campbell, I guess you cut the first day of law school because that's pretty much what happens when someone files a lawsuit.
I level my gaze on her, refusing to be bested. Anna, why are we going to court? She doesn't blink.
Why do you have a service dog?
I wrap my fingers on the steering wheel and look out over the park. A mother pushes a stroller now across the same spot where the jogger was, oblivious to the kid who's trying his best to crawl out. A titter of birds explodes from a tree. I don't talk about this with anyone, I say.
I'm not just anyone.
I take a deep breath. A long time ago, I got sick and wound up with an ear infection. But for whatever reason, the medicine didn't work, and I got nerve damage. I'm totally deaf in my left ear, which isn't such a big deal in the long run, but there are certain lifestyle issues I couldn't handle, like hearing a car approach, you know, but not being able to tell what direction it's coming from, or having someone behind me at the grocery store who wants to pass me by in the aisle, but I don't hear her ask. I got trained with Judge so that in those circumstances he could be my ears. I hesitate. I don't like people feeling sorry for me. Hence the big secret. Anna stares at me carefully.
I came to your office because, just for once, I wanted it to be about me instead of Kate.
But this selfish confession saws out of her sideways. It just doesn't fit. This lawsuit has never been about Anna wanting her sister to die, but simply that she wants a chance to live. You're lying. Anna crosses her arms. Well, you lied first. You hear perfectly fine. And you're a brat. I start to laugh. You remind me of me. Is that supposed to be a good thing? Anna says, but she's smiling. The park is starting to get more crowded. An entire school group walks the path, toddlers tethered together like sled dog huskies, pulling two teachers in their wake. Someone zooms past on a racing bike, wearing the colors of the U.S. Postal Service. Come on, I'll treat you to breakfast. But we're late. I shrug. Who's counting? Judge DeSalvo is not a happy man. Anna's little field trip this morning has cost us an hour and a half. He glares at me when Judge and I hurry into his chambers for the pretrial conference. Your Honor, I apologize. We had a veterinary emergency. I feel, rather than see, Sarah's mouth drop open. That's not what opposing counsel indicated, the judge says. I look DeSalvo right in the eye. Well, it's what happened. Anna was kind enough to help me by keeping the dog calm while the sliver of glass was removed from his paw. The judge is dubious. But there are laws against handicapped discrimination, and I'm playing them to the hilt. The last thing I want is for him to blame Anna for this delay. Is there any way of resolving this petition without a hearing? He asks. I'm afraid not. Anna may not be willing to share her secrets, which I can only respect, but she knows that she wants to go through with this. The judge accepts my answer. Mrs. Fitzgerald, I take it you're still representing yourself? Yes, Your Honor, she says. All right, then. Judge DeSalvo glances at each of us. This is a family court, counselors. In family court, and especially in hearings like these, I tend to personally relax the rules of evidence because I don't want a contentious hearing. I am able to filter out what is admissible and what is not, and if there's something truly objectionable, I'll listen to the objection. But I would prefer that we get through this hearing quickly, without worrying about form. He looks directly at me. I want this to be as painless as possible for everyone involved. We move into the courtroom. One that's smaller than the criminal courts, but intimidating all the same. I swing into the lobby to pick Anna up along the way. As we cross through the doorway, she stops dead. She glances at the vast paneled walls, the rows of chairs, the imposing bench. Campbell, she whispers, I won't have to stand up there and talk, right? The fact is, the judge will most likely want to hear what she has to say. Even if Julia comes out in support of her petition, even if Brian says he will help Anna, Judge DeSalvo may want her to take the stand. But telling her this right now is only going to get her all worked up, and that's not any way to start a hearing. I think about the conversation in the car when Anna called me a liar. There are two reasons not to tell the truth, because lying will get you what you want, and because lying will keep someone from getting hurt. It's for both of these reasons that I give Anna this answer. Well, I say, I doubt it. Judge, I begin. I know it's not traditional practice, but there's something I'd like to say before we start calling witnesses. Judge DeSalvo sighs. Isn't this sort of standing on ceremony exactly what I asked you not to do? Your Honor, I wouldn't ask if I didn't think it was important. Make it quick, the judge says. I stand up and approach the bench. Your Honor, all of Anna Fitzgerald's life, she has been medically treated for her sister's good, not her own. No one doubts Sarah Fitzgerald's love for all her children, or the decisions she's made that have prolonged Kate's life. But today we have to doubt the decisions she's made for this child. I turn and see Julia watching me carefully.
And suddenly I remember that old ethics assignment, and know what I have to say. You might remember the recent case of the firefighters in Worcester, Massachusetts, who were killed in a blaze started by a homeless woman. She knew the fire had started, and she left the building. But she never called 911 because she thought she might get into trouble. 6 men died that night. And yet the state couldn't hold this woman responsible because in America, even if the consequences are tragic, you are not responsible for someone else's safety. You aren't obligated to help anyone in distress. Not if you're the one who started the fire. Not if you're a passerby to a car wreck. Not if you are a perfectly matched donor. I look at Julia again. We're here today because there's a difference in our system of justice between what's legal and what's moral. Sometimes it's easy to tell them apart. But every now and then, especially when they rub up against each other, right sometimes looks wrong, and wrong sometimes looks right. I walk back to my seat and stand in front of it. We're here today, I finish, so that this court can help us all see a little more clearly. My first witness is opposing counsel. I watch Sarah walk to the stand unsteadily, a sailor getting her sea legs again. She manages to get herself into the seat and be sworn in without ever breaking her gaze away from Anna. Judge, I'd like permission to treat Mrs. Fitzgerald as a hostile witness. The judge frowns. Mr. Alexander, I truly would hope that both you and Mrs. Fitzgerald can stand to be civilized here. Understood, Your Honor. I walk towards Sarah. Can you state your name? She lifts her chin a fraction. Sarah Crofton Fitzgerald. You are the mother of the minor child, Anna Fitzgerald? Yes, and also of Kate and Jesse. Isn't it true that your daughter Kate was diagnosed with acute promyelocytic leukemia at age 2? That's right. At that time, did you and your husband decide to conceive a child who would be genetically programmed to be an organ donor for Kate, so that she could be cured? Sarah's face hardens. Not the words I would choose, but that was the story behind Anna's conception, yes. We were planning to use Anna's umbilical cord blood for a transplant. Why didn't you try to find an unrelated donor? It's much more dangerous. The risk of mortality would have been far higher with someone who wasn't related to Kate. So how old was Anna when she first donated an organ or tissue to her sister? Kate had the transplant a month after Anna was born. I shake my head. I didn't ask when Kate received it. I asked when Anna donated it. The cord blood was taken from Anna moments after birth, isn't that right? Yes, Sarah says. But Anna wasn't even aware of it. How old was Anna the next time she donated some body part to Kate? Sarah winces, just as I have expected. She was 5 when she gave donor lymphocytes. What does that involve? Drawing blood from the crooks of her arms. Did Anna agree to let you put a needle in her arm? She was 5 years old, Sarah answers. Did you ask her if you could put a needle in her arm? I asked her to help her sister. Isn't it true that someone had to physically hold Anna down to get the needle in her arm? Sarah looks at Anna, closes her eyes. Yes. Do you call that voluntary participation, Mrs. Fitzgerald? From the corner of my eye, I can see Judge DeSalvo's brows draw together. The first time you took lymphocytes from Anna, were there any side effects? She had some bruising, some tenderness. How long was it before you took blood again? 1 month. Did she have to be held down that time, too? Yes, but what were her side effects then? The same. Sarah shakes her head. You don't understand. It wasn't like I didn't see what was happening to Anna. Every time she underwent a procedure. It doesn't matter which of your children you see in that situation. Every single time, it breaks you apart. And yet, Mrs. Fitzgerald,
You managed to get past that sentiment, I say, because you took blood from Anna a third time. It took that long to get all the lymphocytes, Sarah says. It's not an exact procedure. How old was Anna the next time she had to undergo medical treatment for her sister's well-being? When Kate was 9, she got a raging infection, and again, that's not what I asked. I want to know what happened to Anna when she was 6. She donated granulocytes to fight Kate's infection. It's a process a lot like lymphocyte donation. Another needle stick? That's right. Did you ask her if she was willing to donate the granulocytes? Sarah doesn't answer. Mrs. Fitzgerald, the judge prompts. She turns toward her daughter, pleading. Anna, you know we never did any of these things to hurt you. It hurt all of us. If you got the bruises on the outside, then we got them on the inside. Mrs. Fitzgerald, I step between her and Anna. Did you ask her? Please don't do this, Sarah says. We all know the history. I'll stipulate to whatever it is you're trying to do in the process of crucifying me. I'd rather just get this part over with. Because it's hard to hear it hashed out again, isn't it? I know I'm walking a fine line, but behind me, there is Anna. And I want her to know that someone here is willing to go the distance for her. Added up like this, it doesn't seem quite so innocuous, does it? Mr. Alexander, what is the point of this? Judge DeSalvo says. I am well aware of the number of procedures Anna's undergone. Because we have Kate's medical history, Your Honor, not Anna's. Judge DeSalvo looks between us. Be brief, Counselor. I turn to Sarah. Bone marrow, she says woodenly, before I can ask the question. She was put under general anesthesia because she was so young, and needles were put into the crests of her hips to draw out the marrow. Was it one needle stick, like the other procedures? No, Sarah says quietly. It was about 15. Into the bone? Yes. What were the side effects for Anna this time around? She had some pain. She was given some analgesics. So this time Anna had to be hospitalized overnight, and she needed medication herself. Sarah takes a minute to compose herself. I was told that donating marrow isn't considered a particularly invasive procedure for a donor. Maybe I was just waiting to hear those words. Maybe I needed to hear them at that time. And maybe I wasn't thinking as much of Anna as I should have been, because I was so focused on Kate. But I know beyond a doubt that, like everyone else in our family, Anna wanted nothing more than for her sister to be cured. Well, sure, I reply, so that you'd stop sticking needles in her. Enough, Mr. Alexander, Judge DeSalvo interjects. Wait, Sarah interrupts. I have something to say. She turns to me. You think you can lay it all out in words, black and white, as if it's that easy. But you only represent one of my daughters, Mr. Alexander, and only in this courtroom. I represent both of them equally, everywhere, every place. I love both of them equally, everywhere, every place. But you admitted that you've always considered Kate's health, not Anna's, in making these choices, I point out. So how can you claim to love both of them equally? How can you say that you haven't been favoring one child in your decisions? Aren't you asking me to do that very thing? Sarah asks. Only this time, to favor the other child?
Anna. When you're a kid, you have your own language. And unlike French or Spanish, or whatever you start learning in fourth grade, this one you're born with, and eventually lose. Everyone under the age of 7 is fluent in if-speak. Go hang around with someone under 3 feet tall, and you'll see. What if a giant funnel-web spider crawled out of that hole over your head and bit you on the neck? What if the only antidote for venom was locked up in a vault on the top of a mountain? What if you lived through the bite, but could only move your eyelids and blink out an alphabet? It doesn't really matter how far you go. The point is that it's a world of possibility. Kids think with their brains cracked wide open. Becoming an adult, I've decided, is only a slow sewing shut. During the first recess, Campbell takes me to a conference room for privacy and buys me a Coke that isn't cold.
"So," he says, "what do you think so far?"
Being in the courtroom is weird. It's like I've turned into a ghost. I can watch what's going on, but even if I felt like speaking, no one would be able to hear me. Add to that the very bizarre way I have to listen to everyone talk about my life as if they can't see me sitting right there, and you've landed in my surreal little corner of the earth. Campbell pops open his 7-Up and sits down across from me. He pours a little into a paper cup for Judge, and then takes a good long drink.
"Comments," he says. "Questions? Unadulterated praise for my skillful litigation?"
I shrug. It's not like I expected.
"What do you mean?"
I guess I figured when it started, I'd know for sure that I was doing the right thing. But when my mom was up there and you were asking her all those questions? I glance up at him. That part about it not being simple, she's right. What if I was the one who was sick? What if Kate had been asked to do what I've done? What if one of these days, some marrow or blood or whatever actually worked, and that was the end? What if I could look back on all this one day and feel good about what I did instead of feeling guilty? What if the judge doesn't think I'm right? What if he does? I can't answer a single one of these, which is how I know that whether I'm ready or not, I'm growing up.
Anna.
Campbell gets up and comes around to my side of the table.
Now is not the time to start changing your mind.
I'm not changing my mind. I roll the can between my palms. I think I'm just saying that even if we win, we don't. When I was 12, I started babysitting for twins who live down the street. They're only 6, and they don't like the dark, so I usually wind up sitting between them on a stool that's shaped like the stubby foot of an elephant, toenails and all. It never fails to amaze me how quickly a kid can shut off an energy switch. They'll be climbing the curtains and bam, 5 minutes later they're conked out. Was I ever like that? I can't remember. And it makes me feel ancient. Every now and then, one of the twins would fall asleep before the other one. "Anna," his brother will say, "how many years till I can drive?" 10, I tell him. "How many years till you can drive?" 3. Then the talk will split off like the spokes of a spider web. What kind of car will I buy? What will I be when I grow up? Does it suck to get homework every night in middle school? It's totally a ploy to stay up a little bit later. Sometimes I fall for it. Mostly I just make him go to sleep. See, I get a round, hollow spot in my belly, knowing I could tell him what's coming, but also knowing it would come out sounding like a warning. The second witness Campbell calls is Dr. Bergen, the head of the Medical Ethics Committee at Providence Hospital. He has salt and pepper hair and a face dented in like a potato. He's smaller than you'd expect, too, given the fact that it takes him just short of a millennium to recite his credentials.
"Dr. Bergen," Campbell starts, "what's an ethics committee?"
"A diverse group of doctors, RNs, clergy, ethicists, and scientists who are assigned to review individual cases to protect patient rights. In Western bioethics, there are 6 principles we try to follow." He ticks them off on his fingers.
autonomy, or the idea that any patient over age 18 has the right to refuse treatment, veracity, which is basically informed consent, fidelity, that is, a healthcare provider fulfilling his duties, beneficence, or doing what's best in the interests of the patient, non-maleficence, when you can no longer do good, you shouldn't do harm, like performing major surgery on a terminal patient who's 102 years old, and finally, justice, that no patient should be discriminated against in receiving treatment. What does an ethics committee do? Generally, we're called to convene when there's a discrepancy about patient care. For example, if a physician feels it's in the patient's best interest to go on with extraordinary measures and the family doesn't, or vice versa. So, do you see every case that passes through a hospital? No. Only when there are complaints or if the attending physician asks for a consultation. We review the situation and make recommendations. Not decisions? No, Dr. Bergen says. What if the patient complaining is a minor? Campbell asks. Consent isn't necessary until age 13. We rely on parents to make informed choices for their children up to that point. What if they can't? He blinks. You mean if they're not physically present? No, I mean if there's another agenda they're adhering to, that in some way keeps them from making choices in the best interests of that child. My mother stands up. Objection, she says. He's speculating. Sustained, Judge DeSalvo replies. Without missing a beat, Campbell turns back to his witness. Do parents control their children's health care decisions until age 18? Well, I could answer that. Parents control everything. Unless you're like Jesse and you do enough to upset them, they'd rather ignore you than pretend you actually exist. Legally, Dr. Bergen says. However, once a child reaches adolescence, although they can't give formal consent, they have to agree to any hospital procedure, even if their parents have already signed off on it. This rule, if you ask me, is like the law against jaywalking. Everyone knows you're not supposed to do it, but that doesn't actually stop you. Dr. Bergen is still talking. In the rare instance where a parent and an adolescent patient disagree, the ethics committee weighs several factors. Whether the procedure is in the adolescent's best interests, the risk-benefit scenario, the age and maturity of the adolescent, and the argument he or she presents. Has the ethics committee at Providence Hospital ever met regarding the care of Kate Fitzgerald? Campbell asks. On two occasions, Dr. Bergen says. The first involving allowing her to enter a trial for peripheral blood stem cell transplant in 2002, when her bone marrow transplant and several other options had failed. The second, more recently, involved whether or not it would be in her best interest to receive a donor kidney. What was the outcome, Dr. Bergen? We recommended that Kate Fitzgerald receive a peripheral blood stem cell transplant. As for the kidney, our group was split on that decision. Can you explain? Several of us felt that, at this point, the patient's health care had deteriorated to a point where major invasive transplant surgery was going to do more harm than good. Others believed that without a transplant she would still die, and therefore the benefits outweighed the risk. If your team was split, then who gets to decide what will ultimately happen? In Kate's case, because she's still a minor, her parents. During either of the times your committee met regarding Kate's medical treatment, did you discuss the risks and benefits to the donor? That wasn't the issue at stake. What about the consent of the donor, Anna Fitzgerald? Dr. Bergen looks right at me, sympathetic, which, it turns out, is worse even than him thinking I'm a horrible person for filing this petition in the first place. He shakes his head. It goes without saying that no hospital in the country is going to take a kidney out of a child who doesn't want to donate it. So, theoretically, if Anna was fighting this decision, the case would most likely land on your desk?
Well,
has Anna's case landed on your desk, Doctor?
No.
Campbell advances toward him. Can you tell us why?
Because she isn't a patient.
Really? He pulls a stack of papers out from his briefcase and hands them to the judge, and then to Dr. Bergen. These are Anna Fitzgerald's hospital records at Providence Hospital for the past 13 years. Why would there be records for her if she wasn't a patient?
Dr. Bergen flips through them. She's had several invasive procedures, he admits.
Go, Campbell, I think.
I am not one to believe in knights who ride in to rescue damsels in distress, but I bet it feels a little like this.
Doesn't it strike you as odd that in 13 years, given the thickness of this file and the fact that it exists in the first place, the Medical Ethics Committee never once convened to discuss what was being done to Anna?
We were under the impression that donation was her wish.
Are you telling me that if Anna had previously said she didn't want to give up lymphocytes or granulocytes or cord blood or even a bee sting kit in her backpack, the Ethics Committee would have acted differently?
I know where you're going with this, Mr. Alexander, the psychiatrist says coldly. The problem is that this kind of medical situation hasn't existed before. There is no precedent. We're trying to feel our way as best we can.
Isn't it your job as an ethics committee to look at situations that haven't existed before?
Well, yes.
Dr. Bergen, in your expert opinion, is it ethically right for Anna Fitzgerald to have been asked to donate parts of her own body repeatedly for 13 years?
Objection, my mother calls out.
The judge strokes his chin.
I want to hear this.
Dr. Bergen glances at me again.
Quite frankly, even before I knew that Anna didn't want to be a participant, I voted against her donating a kidney to her sister. I don't believe Kate would live through the transplant, and therefore Anna would undergo a serious operation for no reason at all. Up until this point, however, I think that the risk of the procedures was small compared to the benefits the family as a whole received, and I support the choices the Fitzgeralds made for Anna.
Campbell pretends to consider this.
Dr. Bergen, what kind of car do you drive?
A Porsche.
Bet you like it.
I do, he says guardedly.
What if I told you that you have to give up your Porsche before you leave this courtroom, because that action will save Judge DeSalvo's life?
That's ridiculous. You...
Campbell leans in.
What if you had no choice?
What if, today, psychiatrists simply have to do whatever lawyers decide is in the best interests of others?
He rolls his eyes.
In spite of the high drama you're alluding to, Mr. Alexander, there are basic donor rights, safeguards put in place to medicine so that the greater good doesn't steamroll the pioneers who helped create it. The United States has a long and nasty history of the abuse of informed consent, which is what led to laws relating to human subjects research. It keeps people from being used as experimental lab rats.
Then tell us, Campbell says. How the hell did Anna Fitzgerald slip through the cracks?
When I was only 7 months old, there was a block party in our neighborhood. It's just as bad as you're thinking. Jello molds and towers of cheese cubes and dancing in the street to music piped out of someone's living room stereo. I, of course, have no personal recollection of any of this. I was plopped down in one of those walkers they made for babies before babies started overturning them and cracking their heads open. At any rate, I was in my walker, tooling around between the tables and watching the other kids, so the story goes, when I sort of lost my footing. Our block is canted at an angle, and suddenly the wheels were moving faster than I could make them stop. I whizzed past adults, under the barricade the cops had put up at the end of the road to shut it off to traffic, and I was headed right for the main drag full of cars. But Kate came out of nowhere and ran after me. She somehow managed to grab the back of my shirt moments before I got hit by a passing Toyota. Every now and then, someone on the block brings this up. Me. I remember it as the time she saved me, instead of the other way around. My mother gets her first chance to play lawyer. "Dr. Bergen," she says, "how long have you known my family?" "I've been at Providence Hospital for 10 years now." "In those 10 years, when some aspect of Kate's treatment was presented to you, what did you do?" "Come up with a plan of action that was recommended," he says, "or an alternate, if possible." "When you did, at any point in your report, did you mention that Anna shouldn't be a part of it?" "No." "Did you ever say this would hurt Anna considerably?" "No." "Or put her in grave medical danger herself?" "No." Maybe it's not Campbell, after all, who will turn out to be my white knight. Maybe it's my mother. "Dr. Bergen," she asks, "do you have kids?" The doctor looks up. "I have a son. He's 13. "Have you ever looked at these cases that come to the Medical Ethics Committee and put yourself in a patient's shoes, or better yet, a parent's shoes?" "I have," he admits. "If you were me," my mother says, "and the Medical Ethics Committee handed you back a piece of paper with a suggested course of action that would save your son's life, would you question them further? Or would you just jump at the chance?" He doesn't answer. He doesn't have to. Judge DeSalvo calls a second recess after that. Campbell says something about getting up and stretching my legs. So I start to follow him out, walking right past my mother. As I pass by, I feel her hand on my waist, tugging down my T-shirt, which is riding up in the back. She hates the spaghetti strap girls, the ones who come to school in halters and lowriders, like they're trying out as dancers in a Britney Spears video instead of going to math class. I can almost hear her voice. "Please, tell me that shrank in the wash." She seems to realize mid-tug that maybe she shouldn't have done this. I stop, and Campbell stops too, and her face goes bright red. "Sorry," she says. I put my hand over hers and tuck the shirt into the back of my jeans where it should be. I look at Campbell. "Meet you outside?" He's giving me a look that has "bad idea" written all over it, but he nods and heads down the aisle. Then my mother and I are nearly alone in the courtroom. I lean forward and kiss her on her cheek. "You did really great up there," I tell her, because I don't know how to say what I really want to. That the people you love can surprise you every day. That maybe who we are isn't so much about what we do, but rather what we're capable of when we least expect it.
Sarah, 2002. Kate meets Taylor Ambrose when they are sitting side by side, hooked up to IVs. "What are you here for?" she asks, and I immediately look up from my book, because in all the years that Kate has been receiving outpatient treatment, I cannot remember her initiating a conversation. The boy she is talking to is not much older than she is, maybe 16 to her 14. He has brown eyes that dance and is wearing a Bruins cap over his bald head. "The free cocktails," he answers, and the dimples in his cheeks deepen. Kate grins. "Happy hour," she says, and she looks up at the bag of platelets being infused into her. "I'm Taylor." He holds out his hand. "AML." "Kate, APL. He whistles and raises his brows. "Ooh," he says, "a rarity." Kate tosses her cropped hair. "Aren't we all?" I watch this, amazed. Who is this flirt, and what has she done with my little girl? Platelets, he says, scrutinizing the label on her IV bag. You're in remission? Today, anyway. Kate glances at his pole, the telltale black bag that covers the cytoxin. Chemo? Yeah, today anyway. So, Kate, Taylor says. He has that rangy puppy look of a 16-year-old, one with knobby knees and thick fingers and cheekbones he hasn't yet grown into. When he crosses his arms, the muscles swell. I realize he's doing this on purpose, and I duck my head to hide a smile. What do you do when you're not at Providence Hospital? She thinks, and then a slow smile lights her up from the inside out. Wait for something that makes me come back? This makes Taylor laugh out loud. Maybe sometime we can wait together, he says, and he passes her a wrapper from a gauze pad. Can I have your phone number? Kate scribbles it down as Taylor's IV begins to beep. The nurse comes in and unhooks his line. You're out of here, Taylor, she says. Where's your ride? Waiting downstairs. I'm all set. He gets out of the padded chair slowly, almost weakly, the first reminder that this is not some casual conversation. He slips the piece of paper with our phone number into his pocket. Well, I'll call you, Kate. When he leaves, Kate lets all her breath out in a dramatic finish. She rolls her head after him. Oh, my God, she gasps. He is gorgeous. The nurse, checking her flow, grins. Tell me about it, honey. If only I were 30 years younger. Kate turns to me, blooming. You think he'll call? Maybe, I say. Where do you think we'll go out? I think of Brian, who has always said that Kate can date when she's 40. Let's take one step at a time, I suggest. But inside, I am singing. The arsenic, which ultimately put Kate into remission, worked its magic by wearing her down. Taylor Ambrose, a drug of an entirely different sort, works his magic by building her up. It becomes a habit. When the phone rings at 7 p.m., Kate flies from the dinner table and hides in a closet with the portable receiver. The rest of us clear the dinner plates and spend time in the living room and get ready for bed, hearing little more than giggles and whispers. And then Kate emerges from her cocoon, flushed and glowing, first love beating like a hummingbird at the pulse in her throat. Every time it happens, I can't stop staring. It is not that Kate is so beautiful, although she is. It's that I never really let myself believe that I would see her all grown up. I follow her into the bathroom one night after one of her marathon phone sessions. Kate stares at herself in the mirror, pursing her lips and raising her brows in a come-hither pose. Her hand comes up to her cropped hair. After the chemo, it never grew back in waves, just thick, straight tufts that she usually cultivates with mousse to look like bedhead. She holds her palm out, as if she still expects to see hair shedding. What do you think he sees when he looks at me? Kate asks. I come to stand behind her. She is not the child that mirrors me. That would be Jessie. And yet, when you put us side by side, there are definite similarities. It's not in the shape of the mouth, but the set of it, the sheer determination that silvers our eyes. I think he sees a girl who knows what he's been through, I tell her honestly. I got on the internet and read up on AML, she says. His leukemia's got a pretty high cure rate. She turns to me. When you care more if someone else lives than you do about yourself, is that what love's like? It is hard, all of a sudden, to pull an answer through the tunnel of my throat. Exactly. Kate runs the tap and washes her face with a foam of soap. I hand her a towel, and as she rises from the cloud of it, she says, Something bad's going to happen. On alert, I search her out for clues. What's the matter? Nothing. But that's the way it works. If there's something as good as Taylor in my life, I'm going to pay for it. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, I say, out of habit. Yet there is a truth to this. Anyone who believes that people have ultimate control of what life hands to them needs only to spend a day in the shoes of a child with leukemia. Or her mother. Maybe you're finally getting a break, I say. 3 days later, during a routine CBC, the hematologist tells us that Kate is once again throwing promyelocytes, the first slide down a steep slope of relapse. I have never eavesdropped, at least not intentionally, until the night that Kate comes back from her first date with Taylor to see a movie. She tiptoes into her room and sits down on Anna's bed. "You awake?" she asks. Anna rolls over, groans. "I am now." Sleep slips away from her, like a shawl falling to the floor. "How was it?" "Wow," Kate says, and she laughs. "Wow." "How wow? Like tonsil hockey wow?"
"You are so disgusting,"
Kate whispers, although there's a smile behind it. "But he is a really good kisser." She dangles this like a fisherman.
"Get out,"
Anna's voice shines.
"So what was it like?"
"Flying," Kate answers. "I bet it feels just the same way." "I don't get what that has in common with someone slobbering all over you."
"God, Anna, it's not like he spits on you."
"What does Taylor taste like?"
"Popcorn,"
she laughs,
"and Guy."
"How did you know what to do?"
"I didn't. It just kind of happened.
Like the way you play hockey." This, finally, makes sense to Anna.
"Well," she says, "I do feel pretty good when I'm doing that."
"You have no idea," Kate sighs. There is some movement. I imagine her stripping off her clothes. I wonder if Taylor is imagining the same somewhere. Pillow is punched, cover yanked back, sheets rustle as Kate gets into bed and rolls onto her side.
"Anna?"
"Hmm?" "He has scars on his palms, from graft versus host," Kate murmurs. "I could feel them when we were holding hands."
"Was it gross?"
"No," she says. "It was like we matched." At first, I can't get Kate to agree to undergo the peripheral blood stem cell transplant. She refuses because she doesn't want to be hospitalized for chemo, doesn't want to have to sit in reverse isolation for the next 6 weeks when she could be going out with Taylor Ambrose. "It's your life," I point out to her, and she looks at me as if I'm crazy.
"Exactly,"
she says. In the end, we compromise. The oncology team agrees to let Kate begin her chemo as an outpatient in preparation for a transplant from Anna. At home, she agrees to wear a mask. At the first indication of her counts dropping, she'll be hospitalized. They aren't happy. They worry it will affect the procedure. But like me, they also understand that Kate has reached the age where she can bargain with her will. As it turns out, this separation anxiety is all for naught, since Taylor shows up for Kate's first outpatient chemo appointment.
"What are you doing here?"
"I can't seem to stay away," he jokes. "Hey, Mrs. Fitzgerald." He sits down beside Kate in the empty adjoining chair. "God, it feels good to be in one of these without an IV hookup."
"Rub it in," Kate mutters.
Taylor puts his hand on her arm. "How far into it are you?"
"Just started."
He gets up and sits on the wide arm of Kate's chair, picks the emesis basin up from Kate's lap. $100 says you can't make it till 3 without tossing your cookies. Kate glances at the clock. It is 2:50.
"You're on."
"What did you have for lunch?" he grins, wicked. "Or should I guess based on the colors?"
"You're disgusting,"
Kate says, but her smile is as wide as the sea. Taylor puts his hands on her shoulder. She leans into the contact. The first time Brian touched me, he saved my life. There had been cataclysmic downpours in Providence, a nor'easter that swelled the tides and put the parking lot at the courthouse entirely underwater. I was clerking then, when we were evacuated. Brian's department was in charge. I walked onto the stone steps of the building to see cars floating by, and abandoned purses, and even a terrified paddling dog. While I had been filing briefs, the world I knew had been submerged. "Need a hand?" Brian asked, dressed in his full turnout gear, and he held out his arms. As he swam me to higher ground, rain struck my face and pelted my back. I wondered how, in a deluge, I could feel like I was being burned alive. "What's the longest you've ever gone before throwing up?" Kate asks Taylor. 2 days. "Get out!" The nurse glances up from her paperwork. "True," she confirms. "I saw it with my own eyes." Taylor grins at her. "I told you, I'm a master at this." He looks at the clock. 2:57. "Don't you have anywhere else you'd rather be?" Kate says. "Trying to weasel out of the bet?" "Trying to spare you, although..." Before she can finish, she goes green. Both the nurse and I rise from our seats, but Taylor reaches Kate first. He holds the vomit basin beneath her chin, and when she starts retching, he rubs his hand in slow circles on her upper back. "It's okay," he soothes, close to her temple. The nurse and I exchange glances. "Looks like she's in good hands," the nurse says, and she leaves to take care of another patient. When Kate is finished, Taylor puts the basin aside and wipes her mouth with a tissue. She looks up at him, glow-eyed and flushed, her nose still running. "Sorry," she mutters. "For what?" Taylor says. "Tomorrow it could be me." I wonder if all mothers feel like this in the moment they realize their daughters are growing up, as if it is impossible to believe that the laundry I once folded for her was doll-sized, as if I can still see her dancing in lazy pirouettes along the lip of the sandbox. Wasn't it yesterday that her hand was only as big as the sand dollar she found on the beach? That same hand, the one that's holding a boy's, wasn't it just holding mine, tugging so that I might stop and see the spider web, the milkweed pod, any of a thousand moments she wanted me to freeze? Time is an optical illusion, never quite as solid or strong as we think it is. You would assume that, given everything, I saw this coming. But watching Kate watch this boy, I see I have a thousand things to learn. "I'm some fun date," Kate murmurs. Taylor smiles at her. "Fries," he says. "For lunch." Kate smacks his shoulder. "You are disgusting." He raises one brow. "You lost the bet, you know." "I seem to have left my trust fund at home." Taylor pretends to study her. "Okay, I know what you can give me instead." "Sexual favors?" Kate says, forgetting I am here. "Gee, I don't know," Taylor laughs. "Should we ask your mom?" She goes plum red. "Oops." "Keep this up," I warn, "and your next date will be during a bone marrow aspiration." "You know the hospital has this dance, right?" Suddenly, Taylor is jittery. His knee bobs up and down. "It's for kids who are sick. There are doctors and nurses there, in case, and it's held in one of the conference rooms at the hospital. But for the most part, it's just like a regular prom. You know, lame band, ugly tuxes, punch spiked with platelets." He swallows. "I'm just kidding about that last part. Well, I went last year, stag, and it was pretty dumb. But I figure since you're a patient and I'm a patient, maybe this year we could, like, go together." Kate, with an aplomb I never would have guessed she possesses, considers the offer. "When is it?"
"Saturday."
"As it turns out, I don't have plans to kick the bucket that day," she beams at him. "I'd love to."
"Cool," Taylor says, smiling. "Very cool."
He reaches for a fresh basin, careful of Kate's IV line, which snakes down between them. I wonder if her heart is pumping faster, if it will affect the medication, if she'll be sicker, sooner rather than later. Taylor settles Kate into the crook of his arm. Together, They wait for what comes next. It's too low, I say, as Kate holds a pale yellow dress up below her neck. From the spot on the boutique floor where she is sitting, Anna offers up her opinion, too. You'd look like a banana. We have been shopping for a prom dress for hours. Kate has only 2 days to prepare for this dance, and it has become an obsession. What she will wear, how she will do her makeup, if the band is going to play anything remotely decent. Her hair, of course, is not an issue. After chemo, she lost it all. She hates wigs. They feel like bugs on her scalp, she says. But she's too self-conscious to go commando. Today, she has wrapped a batik scarf around her head, like a proud, pale African queen. The reality of this outing hasn't matched Kate's dreams. Dresses that normal girls wear to proms bear the midriff or shoulders, where Kate's skin is riddled and thickened with scarring. They cling in all the wrong places. They are cut to showcase a healthy, hale body, not to hide the lack of it. The saleswoman who hovers like a hummingbird takes the dress from Kate. It's actually quite modest, she pushes. It really does cover up a fair amount of cleavage. Will it cover this? Kate snaps, popping open the buttons of her peasant blouse to reveal her recently replaced Hickman catheter, which sprouts from the center of her chest. The saleswoman gasps before she can remember to stop herself. Oh, she says faintly. Kate, I scold. She shakes her head.